Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. If you've been listening over the years, you know that on occasion, I've talked about a book that I have recorded. Because among the various things that I do to keep me out of trouble, I record audiobooks. And every once in a while, a book comes along because, you know, you don't really choose them. They choose you. Casting directors get a hold of it, just like you would for a movie or a television show. And they say, hey, we think you've got the right delivery, the right voice for this project, this one over here, that one over there. And a lot of the times you end up recording stuff that you'd never read otherwise. But also every now and then, a book comes across my desk with a request to record it that really, really touches me. And I think maybe three or four times in the 20 years or so that I've been doing this show, I've actually thought to myself, you know something, this deserves a little promotion because it is such a good book. Well, we have that instance today. Recently, I recorded How Enlightenment Changes Your Brain, by Andrew Newberg and Mark Walden. And again, this is a book that we should pay attention to. So we've brought to Common Threads one of the authors, Dr. Andrew Newberg. And we're going to talk about it today. Let me tell you a little bit about both of the authors. Andrew Newberg, MD, our guest, and Mark Waldman are the world's leading experts on spirituality and the brain. They have co-authored four books, including Words Can Change Your Brain, 12 Conversation Strategies to Build Trust, Resolve Conflict, and Increase Intimacy, and the national bestseller, How God Changes Your Brain, picked by Oprah Winfrey as a must-read in 2012. Together, they have authored and edited over 20 books and over 100 academic papers. Their research has been featured in Time, Newsweek, The Washington Post, The New York Times, Forbes, Entrepreneur, Oprah Magazine, and many others. They have both appeared on hundreds of radio and television programs, including PBS and NPR. Dr. Newberg is Director of Research at the Myrna Brind Center of Integrative Medicine at Thomas Jefferson University. He is also a professor in the Departments of Emergency Medicine and Radiology at Thomas Jefferson. He is co-author of the national bestseller, Why God Won't Go Away, Brain Science and the Biology of Belief, and several academic books, including Principles of Neurotheology. So we welcome to Common Threads, Dr. Andrew Newberg. Hello, sir.
Hi, thanks for having me on your program.
Certainly. Again, when I got in touch with you to set this up, I just said that it was an honor to be able to record that book, and I hope I did it justice. We'll find out.
You did a great job. Thank you. And it is a pleasure, and it's always important, I think, to make sure everybody has an opportunity to be able to access this information.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So it is going to be available both in print and audio, whatever floats your boat. So, obviously, Andrew, you've been doing this for quite a while. What do you think, what new material, what new bridges did you cross with this particular book?
Well, as you said, I've been involved in this research for about 20 years, really, going back to the early 1990s, trying to explore the relationship between the brain and our religious and spiritual selves. And some of the early work we did looked at basic practices like meditation and prayer and what they do to the human brain. And over the years, a couple of things started to kind of coalesce, which ultimately ended up getting us to be able to write about enlightenment, these very, very intense, very powerful experiences. And certainly one of them is that we've recognized that there are these moments in people's lives that really change who they are. They change everything about themselves. And those are they're often described as spiritual experiences, mystical experiences, enlightenment experiences. But from our point of view, as someone who has really explored these experiences in the everyday person, part of the problem, I think, that was really missing was what do these experiences actually feel like for everyone. For the most part, when we hear about enlightenment, we think about, you know, Buddha, or we think about, you know, some enlightened monk or religious figure in history. But it turns out, as we started to explore this and we started to take a survey of really a couple thousand people around the world who had these kinds of experiences, we realized that you don't have to be a Buddha, you don't have to be a mystic to be able to have this kind of an experience and to have this kind of life-changing moment that it sort of radically shifts everything that goes on in your brain and everything that goes on in your life. So to me, some of the really new material that's here in large part derives from our survey, and this was an online survey that we accumulated information over about a five-year period of a couple thousand different experiences. And it's a treasure trove of data that we talk about in the book about what these experiences are like, how people describe them, how they affect people, and we can certainly talk about that more as we go through the interview today. But we also part of the reason why I wanted to have that survey was to get a better understanding of the subjective nature of these experiences. What do people really feel? What do they experience? What do they think? And in so doing, we can tie that back into what we understand about the human brain and tie it to some of the newest brain scan studies that we've done of some very intense practices where people really do have these big shifts in their consciousness, shifts in the way they think about things, and put all of it together into helping us understand what enlightenment is, how it actually may happen, and try to provide people some guideposts for helping them to get to that kind of an experience that may change their own lives. And that, to me, is the practical element of this, which is trying to show people the paths that might ultimately work for them. And obviously, I could never guarantee enlightenment for everyone, but at least we can start heading people down the right path.
In the book, you talk about both the big E enlightenment experiences and the lowercase, the small e enlightenment experiences. And so let's talk about that. And also, even with the big E enlightenment, a lot of people, you know, enlightenment can mean different things to different people. And I think a lot of people think about enlightenment as transcending the human condition totally, you know,
right,
almost levitating, never having a sorrowful moment or a feeling of attachment for the rest of their lives. It's not that, right?
It can be that, but yes, it's not always that, absolutely. And, let's go with your first question first, that, you know, part of what we realized is that as we started to look at this vast array of different experiences and we started to think about this in more detail, we decided that it was appropriate to divide enlightenment into, as you mentioned, the small e, the lowercase e enlightenment experiences, and the capital E enlightenment cases. And the reason that we do that in part is because we wanted people to realize that everyone has access to these kinds of experiences. And for the most part, I would say almost all the listeners have had at least some of the small ones. Sometimes it's just a revelation about what to do with your job, meeting the right person who you're going to marry and live with the rest of your life, and that sudden realization. And these are these sort of minor, sometimes people refer to them as these aha moments or eureka moments that help you solve a particular issue or bring some new understanding to a specific idea that does change your life, but doesn't change it so much from the deep inside, but at least makes a significant impact on your life and redirects you into some hopefully very positive kind of direction. But this is also part of how we can start to understand the nature of the big E enlightenment experiences that really do have this radical effect on a person. And while I agree with you that this doesn't inherently mean that they wind up, you know, kind of floating into some spiritual realm and never to return basically to their physical body, what people often do describe are these incredibly intense experiences, experiences that provide a deep sense of knowledge and understanding to them, a sense of wisdom perhaps, that then they can take that information and use that to now look at their lives, look at the world, look at their religious and spiritual beliefs in an entirely new way that really sets them up for the rest of their life to be the kind of person that hopefully that they want to be. And again, I think part of what the data is showing is that this exists within all of us. Everyone has the opportunity to be able to do that. It is not just the mystics. It's not just the Buddhas of the world. But it is something that all of us have an opportunity to ultimately experience. And we can learn from the other experiences that people had to give us a better sense as to how it's happening, what are the ways in which people, the pathways that people have taken that have gotten them towards that experience, and how do we ultimately understand it? How can we kind of utilize all this information for the betterment of mankind?
You have this criteria for an enlightenment experience. I believe there are five, one of them being that it changes you. What are the others?
So, excuse me. When we have looked at these several thousand descriptions of these experiences and then also brought in prior scholars looking at these kinds of experiences, what we realized is that there are some overall concepts that seem to be universal to all of them. And so, you know, for example, you mentioned one of them, which in many ways is one of the more important ones, although they're all fundamentally essential to these experiences. But one of them is this sense of transformation that changes the person and has this transformative effect that changes the person literally forever. So, you know, whatever their current way of thinking about things was, this experience happens, and going forward, it just completely transforms who they are and the ways they think. And of course, this also means that it transforms their brain as well. Now, part of what makes it this permanence, makes these experiences have this permanent effect on people, are several of the other characteristics. So, for example, one of them is the intensity of the experience. And that to me is always very important and interesting because sometimes the intensity relates to different elements. So somebody may have a very intense emotional experience. They may feel the most incredible sense of God's love, for example, that they've ever felt. They just felt just completely enveloped in love. Other people may have an intense experience of something sensory, the most beautiful music they've ever heard, the most beautiful vision, or the most beautiful light that they've ever experienced. And sometimes people just have this incredibly intense experience of knowledge that they get it and they understand what the world is in a very, very powerful way. But it's this intensity that kind of knocks the person from where they are to this new way of thinking about things. Now, one of the other things that I also just alluded to, one of the other elements, is the sense of clarity. And that is also something that seems to come from all of these experiences, that the person really does get it now. They you know, before they were struggling, they were trying to figure out their life, they didn't really know what was right, what was wrong, the ways to be, and so forth. And they come to this experience, and from that moment forward, they understand, or at least they feel that they understand, the way the world works, the way they're supposed to be as a person. And again, this sort of clarity of that experience is so vivid that it changes ultimately the way that they feel about things. And then finally, a sense of oneness, a sense of connectedness, and whether that sense of connectedness is to God, to some universal consciousness, to ultimate reality, to the universe, whatever it is, there's this very powerful sense of oneness that infiltrates these experiences and is in many ways another essential aspect of them. So these are some of the basic categories. Now, what's also interesting is that each of the individual, the specific elements of these experiences can be different for people. And so sometimes people can feel enlightenment and turn towards one particular religious tradition. Somebody else feels it and they turn towards another one. And as I mentioned, some people have emotions, some people have sensory experiences. It can be very varied, but these basic categories are the things that we tend to see as universal in all of the experiences that people have.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella. My guest today, Dr. Andrew Newberg, author of the book, How Enlightenment Changes Your Brain. And talking about these various criteria, you mentioned that somebody might feel a connection to God or universal consciousness, and you named a couple of other things that might be considered synonymous with God with a capital G. But also, in the book, you say that some people, their big E enlightenment was that there is no God. That's fascinating.
Well, and you know, it really derives even going back several hundred years to the Age of Enlightenment, which interestingly used the term enlightenment. to basically mean that we're getting away from these archaic, you know, supernatural religious belief systems, and they felt that that was what enlightenment ultimately was, to kind of bring the mind to another place based on rational thought and experience that was different than the doctrinal and supernatural elements that was found in most of the religious traditions at that time. So, and that's part of why we realized that the fundamental components of enlightenment experiences doesn't necessarily have to be religious or spiritual, although many of them are, of course, and doesn't necessarily have to end the person up with any given belief system, at least in terms of the specifics. But what we do find is that irrespective of whether the person turns to a religious or spiritual belief or a non-religious or spiritual belief, what we do find is that people have far more positive experiences about themselves, about their relationships, about the nature of humanity, about how they're to be interacting with the world, and they feel that they really get the world and understand the world in a very fundamental way. So they have a sense of peace and calmness and connectedness that really inundates their entire being. And that it is interesting, though, that sometimes people do come away with those experiences without necessarily having something particularly spiritual. But I think on a very basic level, there's that similarity of all of these experiences, and whether ultimately one defines it as God or the universe or consciousness, whatever it is that they ultimately define it as, maybe variations on a theme, or ultimately they may be fundamentally different experiences. And that's part of what our research also is now trying to explore, which is how similar and dissimilar these experiences actually are.
Could it be that people who come away from such an experience with an understanding that there is no God, could it be that perhaps they had a preconceived definition of God, maybe a Sistine Chapel ceiling God, and having this experience shattered that, and they don't know what to replace it with? Is that possible?
Absolutely, and that actually is a common theme, even for those people who wind up in a much more spiritual place. When we looked at our survey and we asked people, did they feel that they were more religious or more spiritual? Well over 90% of people said yes, that they were more spiritual. Probably about 50 or 60% of them said that they were more religious. So, and I think the common concept, which is what you really just mentioned, is this notion that the experience is almost too big to fit within the doctrines and the ideas and the belief systems that the person grew up in or was holding at that particular time. They had a very maybe concrete notion of God, like you said, like a sort of Sistine Chapel, man with the beard in the clouds kind of concept, a very anthropomorphic idea about God. And then they have this experience of God's love or God's spirit or whatever that is so beyond anything like that, that it really changes the way they think. And again, some people then ultimately go completely away and they say, well, religion just can't even describe this. Other people still find their path into a particular religious tradition, but now with a very different understanding about what God actually is.
And let's talk about your experience, because you're quite open about it in the book. It actually begins with your sea of doubt. And I think it's so fascinating, because I know some people who would say they struggle with doubt. And there are other people who doubt, but they don't struggle with it. It's not it doesn't take up much of their time or emotional energy the way it does with some people who struggle with doubt. So if you would, share that part of your life.
Oh, well, sure. And I guess, in some ways I wound up being a little bit of both, as you were just saying, because for a very long time as I was growing up, I was always very inquisitive as a child. I was always encouraged to ask a lot of questions and to challenge my beliefs and my ideas and try to figure out what's going on in the reality around me. And as I began to pursue those kinds of questions, I thought, well, I wanted to start with things that I could really grasp onto. I thought science would be very good in terms of helping us answer questions about the material world and the physical world around us. and I love science, and still do, but also came to realize that there were certain limitations, even in what science could tell me about my beliefs about the world, because my beliefs are just that. They are my beliefs, and they come from inside of me to a large extent, that I realized I needed to kind of go inside and think about where my own beliefs came from. And so that whole process became very much a kind of contemplative type of process for me. It was meditative in many ways, and I spent a great deal of time in my own mind kind of focusing on these, you know, what I could know. And I wound up taking this kind of path of saying, well, if I don't know it, rather than just completely discarding it, I'll just say, well, I'm going to doubt it. And interestingly, the more I kind of explored all these questions, the more I wound up putting everything into this kind of large area, this large ocean of doubt, so to speak. But eventually, it turned into an experience in which I became very comfortable with that doubt. And in fact, in many ways, it was something that really transformed my way of thinking, because I had been struggling with this doubt for so long. And then when I kind of realized that the doubt was okay, then it enabled me to feel far more comfortable. In fact, and today, as I go forward as a scientist and as someone who explores these questions, a field some refer to as neurotheology, to me, the more I question and the more I doubt, the better I feel. And so it enables me to kind of explore and try to understand our world without necessarily having to have something specific, some definitive factual basis by which I can try to look at the world. And for that, it's been very helpful for me, and it continues to help me to pursue these kinds of questions.
Now, you grew up Jewish. Do you still identify as a Jew?
Yes. I definitely would not say that I am. I'm not an observant Jew by any stretch, but I think a lot of my background and the ways that I think about things derive from that tradition, but I'm not someone who particularly would go to synagogue other than kind of the primary holidays and so forth. But I think a lot of my ideas and a lot of my perspectives on things come from that particular background that I grew up with, and so there is an identification there, but I don't typically consider myself to be a highly religious individual. I think I would usually define myself more as a spiritual person, and to a large extent, this whole path of neurotheology and exploring these questions and exploring the nature of God and enlightenment through the processes of science as well as the experiences themselves, that has become my spiritual path. It's actually a kind of a combined spiritual and scientific path.
No, I understand that. My question, though, is if you're going to be someone who deals with doubt, isn't Judaism a pretty good religion to be a part of?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, certainly, part of what Judaism is about, the term Israel actually means to struggle. And so there's always that notion of kind of struggling with religion, struggling with the notion of God, questioning, exploring. And again, I guess that's really what I meant when I said that a lot of my approaches to things with that kind of struggling and doubting and questioning derive from the tradition itself. So it is a very, it's commensurate with the way I tend to approach things.
Sure. What is the, and I don't even know if you can answer this, but perhaps you can lead us in this direction. What is the response from establishment neurophysicians and people in the medical field in general to your work?
Well, I think that over the years, it's actually been fairly positive, and hopefully I'm not saying that with some naive ignorance is bliss kind of perspective, but, I've tried to look at this whole field in a very cautious way. I've tried very hard to preserve what science can say, when I talk about neurotheology as a concept, I always say it's important to keep science rigorous, but also religion religious. And so I think it's very important to respect both sides, to acknowledge the importance of both sides and what they can bring to the table. And so when I talk about my research, I try very hard not to draw Very difficult conclusions, that are difficult for the scientific community to accept. I explore what the possibilities are and the options are, but I try to leave it in such a way that even the staunchest of scientists who doesn't believe in anything supernatural can at least say, well, this is interesting. We're looking at a part of humanity, a part of the human psyche that has obviously been around with us since the dawn of history and the dawn of humanity. And maybe trying to understand it and how it affects us and how it works for us may be important information, even though they may not necessarily feel religious or spiritual themselves. And I think in the larger medical community, there's also been a growing realization over time that we have to do a better job at taking care of people, not just trying to fix a problem. And so there's been a lot of emphasis on trying to get beyond purely thinking about the human person as just biological, but to understand them as a psychological, as a social, and as a spiritual person, and to look at those different elements, those different facets of the human person, those different dimensions of the human person that is really necessary for healing people. And so I think that overall, again, my experience has generally been a fairly positive one. People appreciate the perspective that we're taking, trying to be careful with the science, trying to understand something that's very difficult to understand, and realizing the ultimate importance of it in so many people's lives that maybe we really do need to make sure that we understand it as best as we can, and using some of these methods and techniques becomes valuable.
Dr. Newberg, unfortunately, we're out of time this week, but this is a fascinating conversation, and I certainly would love to invite you back next week, and we can wrap this up.
Sounds good.
You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella, and I've been speaking with Dr. Andrew Newberg about his book, How Enlightenment Changes Your Brain. Please join us again next week right here on Common Threads.